Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The city of San Francisco is going through major changes. The city now has the most expensive rental market in the country, beating out New York City. It's almost impossible to find a studio for less than $2,000 a month. Rents in popular neighborhoods like the Mission have doubled over the past 2 years, and home sales now average $1 million. San Francisco is undergoing a massive construction boom that will bring about 4,000 new housing units to the city in the coming months. And at the same time, evictions are at a 12-year high. Every month in San Francisco, 100 households lose their long-term housing through a mix of evictions and paid buyouts. Several of these changes began when Silicon Valley tech workers began moving en masse to the city. 14,000 tech workers travel back and forth between Silicon Valley and San Francisco every day. This is according to Stamen Design. They are tracking the buses that have become infamous. Google runs about 150 bus trips a day all over the city. Now, tech firms get the most attention when we talk about San Francisco's changing landscape, but the city is also home to more than 30 international financial institutions and corporations like Bechtel. And then there are the land developers and real estate firms that have also transformed the city's landscape with major residential and commercial projects. So how do all these powerful forces shape the political and cultural landscape of San Francisco? On today's Your Call, we continue our agenda for a new economy series by talking about the city's power elites. How do they influence decisions about issues like development and the economy, issues like tax breaks for tech companies? And how successful have grassroots community organizers been in challenging these powerful interests? And how does what happened in San Francisco affect your area if you do not live in the city? Today, we're joined by Gray Brecken, an historical geographer and visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography. He's founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project and author of the seminal book Imperial San Francisco. And Gray is here in studio. Hi, Gray.
Hi. Great to be here.
Thank you for coming back. We're also joined by Tim Redmond, former San Francisco Bay Guardian editor. He covers San Francisco politics at the blog Tim's San Francisco. He is also launching the San Francisco Progressive Media Center. It's a nonprofit online daily newspaper, and Tim and others are having a fundraiser for this new project this Thursday at El Rio in the Mission from 6 to 9 p.m. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Tim. Great to see you.
Happy to be back.
Thanks for coming in. So first off, we've got listeners all over Northern California, from Napa to Santa Cruz. Why should people who live outside of San Francisco care about all of these changes that are happening in San Francisco and who's really making the decisions? Gray, why should they care?
Well, you know, I wrote my book Imperial San Francisco to talk about how cities aren't just places that are defined by a boundary. I mean, great cities, imperial cities, as I call them. They are, in fact, regions, and even beyond regions. They control what in the book I called a contado, which is an Italian term for the hinterland. And San Francisco's reach very quickly after the gold rush and the silver rush became not only included the western United States, but the entire Pacific Basin as well. A city like San Francisco goes off like a nuclear bomb as far as its effect on the environment. And it has tremendous environmental impacts, but they're also ruled by a very small number of people to their own benefit. Mm-hmm. Now, San Francisco has been the city, the lead city of Northern California and the lead city of the Bay Area. That gets a little mushed up now because Silicon Valley plays much the role to it that, say, Virginia City did in the 1860s and 70s. It's a source of enormous wealth. But San Francisco still controls a great deal of the finance that affects the whole Bay Area and beyond to a great extent.
What would you add to that, Tim?
Well, if you live in Berkeley or Oakland, you're already feeling the impacts significantly.
Because a lot of people are moving there.
And housing prices are being driven up. I mean, when you drive up housing prices to that level in San Francisco, ordinary people are moving. And in fact, people who make decent incomes, who are just not stinking rich, move to Oakland and drive up housing prices there. And then people in Oakland are forced to move out. And that impacts, I mean, the exodus of San Franciscans to surrounding areas has a huge impact. And the other thing that we have to remember, Gray was talking about environmental impact. We now have a situation, all right, tech is big, but the number one private industry in the city is still hospitality, tourism, right? The number one industry overall is government. That's where there are more jobs. But tourism, hospitality, those people, the people who work in hotels and restaurants, can't afford the rent in the Mission anymore. Now they're living in Antioch, and they're commuting every day from far out of town to San Francisco, which puts additional pressure not only on regional transportation systems, but on the roads and the bridges. So wherever you are, this explosive growth of wealth in San Francisco, gross wealth, is having an impact on you.
So how do you explain what's happening right now? Because the changes are happening so incredibly fast. I mean, if you live in San Francisco, the changes in the Mission, I was just there last night, and it changes by the week, it feels like. Why is this happening? Why are rents going through the roof? Why are so many people being priced out?
Well, you have the growth of Silicon Valley, and you have these industries outside of San Francisco where their workers are mostly young. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg, I think, said recently they have to be young. CEO of Facebook said, yeah, we want young people, which, of course, is, as we all know, those of us who are not kids anymore, that is against the law to just hire young people. Being aside from that, they're young. They don't want to live in Silicon Valley, which is a kind of an older suburban area. They want to live in San Francisco where it's cool. And their employers have purchased these expensive luxury buses to get them back and forth so it's easy to commute down there. So they all want to live in San Francisco. This, you know, years ago, people from the suburbs commuted into San Francisco to work. Now people live in San Francisco and commute to the suburbs to work. We basically have become the bedroom community for Silicon Valley. And because there's such enormous wealth there, and because the city lacks the ability to protect its existing rental stock, people in the city, you mentioned 17,000 tech workers moving to the city, all of them want your apartment. And many of them can pay more for your apartment than you can. And because we have weak laws protecting rental housing, and we have landlords who are more than happy to take advantage of the situation. We have the enormity of the greed in the San Francisco real estate industry is stunning. People taking advantage of this, throwing out families who've been in the city for 20, 30 years just so that they can bring in someone who can pay a little more rent.
Yeah, and I just wanted to actually go back again to the Comstock load, because in my studies, what I found is that the real wealth, the dynastic wealth, is not made from, in that case, mining, in many cases, technology today. It actually is founded on land, because as Mark Twain said, buy it, they're not making it anymore. So the more people there are, of course, the higher the value of land goes. And if you want to really establish dynastic wealth, you buy land and you invest in it. And I suspect the same thing is going on now, too. You can actually see with Larry Ellison, for example. He's been on a buying binge lately where he's bought, you know, one of the Hawaiian Islands, as well as he's buying up the coast of Malibu, etc. I asked a reporter from the San Jose Mercury News one time if the Silicon Valley Kings are actually investing out in the San Joaquin Valley and Tracy and other things like that. And he said, well, I don't know. We've never investigated that. You can bet that they are. And I suspect they're also investing in downtown San Francisco. It's difficult to find out, however, because 100 years ago, all of those records were easily accessible in what were called block books. I did a lot of my research in that. And you could go to the map and find out who owned what. Now they're hidden behind things like real estate investment trusts, etc. So it's much more difficult to do that kind of research. Tim was working with the Bay Guardian in 1984. The Guardian did an extraordinary investigative piece on the two leading newspapers in San Francisco at that time, in which the Guardian did what a paper is supposed to do, investigate, and found out not only the dynastic lineage of the Hearst and DeYoung families, but also how much land those families owned. And you could see immediately the kind of conflict of interest in the mass media.
So, Gray, you said that the city is ruled by a small number of people. So, I mean, our main question is who runs or who owns San Francisco?
You know, I'm going to have to toss to Tim on that because it's such a new city at this point. There's been an enormous turnover of the people who actually run the city. I can tell you that Willie Brown, of course, has immense power. He is a fixer, and he has this connection, of course, with the San Francisco Chronicle. There was recently a profile of Willie Brown by Leslie Ann Stevens in the Washingtonian magazine, I think it was, in which she said that his position as a columnist in the Chronicle violated even that paper's lax ethical standards, because he is still a fixer, you know. And then, of course, you have Dianne Feinstein, Nancy Pelosi. These people wield enormous power, but their real constituents, their true constituents, are not those of us who write to those people. It's those who pay them, because we have a plutocracy now, you know, and those are their true constituents. And those frequently are the people who own the land, the real estate developers. This has been true with Feinstein ever since she was a very pro-development mayor. And so those are the people. I mean, Tim, would you like to jump
in? It's interesting because San Francisco, the city itself, has been transformed. The demographics have been transformed. The city landscape is being transformed very rapidly in the past 5 to 10 years. Not that long ago, I was writing about how San Francisco politics, how power in San Francisco had become fairly diffuse. When Gavin Newsom was mayor, he was happy to show up for press conferences and he had a big smile, but he didn't really do anything in terms of actually accomplishing things. Power in the city was more vested in a district elected board of supervisors where you had 11 people from 11 different parts of the city. And you had a mayor who was not an all-powerful type. And the power brokers, the Willie Browns of the world, were kind of off on the side in those days. And all of a sudden, very quickly, as the tech boom started happening again, and as land values started going up very rapidly, we've seen a tremendous and extraordinary consolidation of power in the city. The hand-picked selection of Ed Lee as mayor, influence of Willie Brown, who is his buddy, of Rose Pack, who is his friend, and of people like Ron Conway. Ron Conway is a venture capitalist in the tech industry who was very close to the mayor. The influence of these people is extraordinary on what goes on in San Francisco. But the true power in the city still in many ways rests with, as Gray said, the landowners, the landlords, the real estate developers, the real estate interests. They're the ones who are driving a lot of this because, look, the tech workers, we can complain about the sudden wealth and we can complain about how 25-year-olds don't know what to do with all this money and aren't thinking about what the community is like that they're moving into. But in reality, these are working folks who are looking for a place to live. And they have enough money to pay more for an apartment than you, but they're just basically looking for a place to live. It's the landlords. It's the people who own that property who are really making all the money here, who are making a killing by charging people exorbitant rents, even for the amounts of money that the tech workers are making. They're paying exorbitant rents, often crammed together, 5 or 6 people in a, you know, in a small flat, paying thousands and thousands of dollars a month because the landlords in San Francisco are taking advantage of the situation. And, you know, you look at it, you think about how we would feel if there had just been an earthquake in San Francisco, a fairly serious earthquake.
And there will be.
What? There will be. But imagine if right after a serious earthquake, a few people were walking around the city selling bottles of water for $100 and selling food at 10 times its value to desperately hungry and thirsty people. The city would be up in arms, and you would have to think that city officials would say, this is disgraceful. You're taking horrible advantage of a situation and you're hurting vulnerable people by doing that. Well, that's what the landlords are doing right now. And everybody's saying it's just normal. I mean, that's what's going on. We have had an economic earthquake in the city, and no one, I'm not seeing the mayor stand up and say, wait a minute, the law, this, you know, evicting elderly tenants from places they've lived and raised their families all their lives, you may be able to get away with it legally, but it's shameful. And someone ought to be standing up and saying it's shameful.
And, you know, we've been here before because, again, to go back to the Comstock Lode, we saw the same thing at that time in the 1870s. One of the people who made their money was George Hearst, and his son, William Randolph Hearst, at the tender age of about 22, wrote to his pop and said, take your money out of mining, put it into land, as he said in his letter to his pop at that time. Every atom of humanity added to the struggling mass means another figure to the landlord's bank account. So the Hearst fortune has always been based very much on land as well as on media, perhaps even more so. And it's appropriate that in San Francisco, a journalist comments commented on all this actually wrote a book about it. It was Henry George, a journalist, who wrote a book called Progress and Poverty, which was an all-time bestseller at that time, which sought to explain why it is that with great wealth, you also have great and obscene poverty at the same time. And, I mean, for myself, I don't believe that you can actually have billionaires and have democracy at the same time because of their immense and disproportionate power in shaping cities and countries.
That is Gray Brecken. He's an historical geographer and a visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. He's also author of the book Imperial San Francisco. We're also joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He covers politics and all of these issues at his blog, Tim's San Francisco. He's in the process of launching the San Francisco Progressive Media Center. And as part of that, he'll be launching a nonprofit online daily paper. He and his team will be having a fundraiser at El Rio in the Mission District this Thursday night, 6 to 9 p.m. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And today we are talking about San Francisco. Who owns San Francisco? Who are the major players? And we'd love to hear from you. What changes have you seen over the last couple of decades? What questions do you have about who's making important decisions about development, the economy, the tax breaks that are given to tech companies that move to the mid-market area? And Gray also and Tim talked about why this is important to those of you who live outside of the city. How does what happened here affects your city? And do you know who makes the important decisions where you live? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Tim, you were talking about the influential developers. Can you give us some names?
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's obviously the Shorenstein Company, Doug Shorenstein, whose father Walter built about half of downtown San Francisco, remains a very influential player. The organized groups like the Building Owners and Managers Association and the organized development groups have a tremendous outsized role. And so increasingly now are the residential, the people who are building residential high-rise places. You know, when I was in the 80s, we were fighting against commercial high-rise office buildings that were transforming the city. Now, what we're seeing is all of the money is going into residential high-rise development of ultra-luxury levels. I mean, we're building a lot of housing in San Francisco, but none of it is affordable to the average San Franciscan. It's all housing for people who don't currently live here. And those folks are getting away with murder in terms of getting spot zoning and special tax breaks and everything else. I mean, there's a guy, this is going to be on the November ballot, so we, you know, it's worth mentioning. There's a guy named Simon Snellgrove who's trying to build 130 condos on the waterfront at 8 Washington that will be, he says, the most expensive new condominiums ever built in San Francisco. He intends to sell them for around $10 million or so. And these are on the waterfront, right? He is, by most accounts, going to make about $400 million off of this project. Okay? This is astonishing money. Now, when you look at the profit levels that you're making off of building high-end housing in San Francisco now, it's absolutely stunning. $400 million. There's a guy, Russ Flynn, who is one of the biggest landlords in town, owns about 3,000 units. He is taking a building he owns on Nob Hill with 33 apartments in it and converting it into tenancies in common, which is the, you know, equivalent of a back doorway around the condo law. He is basically going to kick out all of the tenants there and turn that into tenancies in common. He paid $35 million for the building. He's going to put about $10 million into renovating it, and he's going to sell it for $100 million. So in one fell swoop, he's going to make $50 million on a $35 million investment, and it's going to take a couple of months to do it. So this is the kind of money that we're talking about. And when that kind of money is flowing around, it buys a lot of political influence. You know, it's interesting. The Silicon Valley types, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. Mark Zuckerberg has a place in the Mission.
And it reportedly paid $10 million for
it. Through a bunch of dummy corporations, so we can't actually find out where it is. But we now know where he is because he's spending a lot of money renovating it and everybody knows. But those folks thus far have been relatively quiet on the San Francisco political scene, with the exception of Ron Conway, who's a venture capitalist. I mentioned him before, very close to the mayor, and is really throwing his weight around politically and trying to get the tech folks to get more involved in San Francisco politics. A lot of them are still young, though, and not that civically involved yet. And instead, the decisions are being driven by landowners and developers.
Hmm. Do these landowners and developers live in San Francisco?
Some of them do. Some of them do. A lot of them don't. I mean, a lot of the money that's coming into San Francisco is through real estate investment trusts that are based outside of the city. There are developers from all over the city, all over the country, all over the world. I mean, when you look at it's another gold rush that's happening right now. San Francisco was founded on extractive industry, right? Taking something out of the ground, processing it and selling it somewhere else. And in a sense, that's what they're doing now. They're taking, you know, you've got investors from all over the world putting in money to extract wealth out of San Francisco. And it's happening at an alarming pace. And you know, it's being fed by the Silicon Valley boom. But really, as Gray says, the ones who are making the most money out of this in the long term are going to be the ones who are buying and selling and developing land.
What about international players?
We are starting to see international players. It's interesting. Willie Brown, whose hands seem to be in just about everything these days. Willie Brown is working
tentacles.
With a group who are putting together a program under a relatively obscure federal law that allows people who are not citizens of the United States, who are willing to invest $1 million or more in something that allegedly creates jobs. And I think you only have to create 4 jobs. But you invest $1 million or more in a project, you can get an automatic green card. So we have the country is rapidly deporting hardworking residents who have been here for a long time, and immigrants are being driven out of San Francisco. But if you got a couple million bucks, and a lot of folks from China who are newly wealthy are doing this now, but it's not just from China. If you got a few million bucks and you give it to Willie Brown and he sets up these consortiums, you can basically buy a green card. And so there's money coming into the country, into San Francisco that way, too.
Well, let's take a few callers before we go to break. Let's hear from Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you and good morning. I really appreciate this show, and I know it's a problem there in San Francisco, but it also is a problem in Santa Cruz. And we have a I've been wondering about this and wondering who's buying up the properties here. And the thing is that I find the most astonishing is about early in August, I read a letter to the editor of the Sentinel, and the woman that wrote it, there was an issue going on about all renters are problems, or all landlords are problems. And so this woman wrote and said, people that provide a place for us to rent really should be considered public servants because they're bringing a place for people to live. And I thought, wow, we have really gone downhill.
Well, Linda, what changes are you seeing in Santa Cruz?
Oh, rents are sky high. You know, they're people talk about greed because they can, and the rental market is very tight. There's a lot of fraud over things like with Craigslist with different people. And I had a situation happen with a woman who, by the way, is a Russian immigrant, who was doing welfare fraud, and she got me illegally evicted. And I tried to bring this to the district attorney, consumer affairs, and I am woefully out of luck. There is no law protecting me anywhere. And even though the sheriff tells me what she's doing is a felony, it's false impersonation, and there's nothing I can do about it unless I take her to court.
Well, Linda, I'm sorry to hear about your personal situation. We're going to go to break, and what we'll do after the break is talk about the laws protecting renters, because especially in San Francisco, we often hear that those of us who rent have a lot of protections, and we often hear that landlords, you know, don't like these protections because we have so much power. And is that the case, and what does the law actually say? Today on Your Call, we are talking about who owns San Francisco. We're seeing so many changes in the city. And why is this important to those of you who live outside of the city? What changes are you seeing? And when you follow the money, where does it go? It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. If you'd like to add your perspective to today's discussion or ask a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch with us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a discussion about restorative justice programs in the prison system in California. How do these programs work and where are they taking place? That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with Rose George. She's author of 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, The Invisible Industry That Puts Clothes on Your Back, Gas in Your Car, and Food on Your Plate. How is the shipping industry affecting globalization and affecting the choices that you make when you go to the store? That's on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about San Francisco, the major changes that we're seeing, and the movers and shakers in San Francisco. Who makes the decisions? Who really owns the city? I'm sure you've heard that we now have the highest rents in the country, beating out New York City. It's almost impossible to find a studio apartment for less than $2,000 a month. San Francisco's undergoing a massive construction boom that will bring 4,000 new housing units to the city over the coming months. Evictions, at the same time as this is happening, are at a 12-year high. Every month, 100 people lose their long-term housing through a mix of evictions and paid buyouts. So what questions do you have about these changes? Who's really making the decisions? What do you want to know about who's making the decisions? And what would you like to talk about in your area if you live outside of the city? What changes are you seeing where you live? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Gray Brecken, historical geographer and visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. He's the author of Imperial San Francisco. Tim Redmond is the former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He now covers politics at Tim San Francisco, and he's launching the San Francisco Progressive Media Center. They're going to launch a nonprofit online daily newspaper, and they're having a fundraiser on Thursday at El Rio in the Mission from 6 to 9 p.m. And we had a caller earlier about renters and their rights. And you know, a lot of people often say that renters in San Francisco have a lot of power. Is that true, Tim?
Well, once upon a time, it was relatively hard to evict people in San Francisco, but now it's not. In fact, tenants have less rights and less power than they've had in a long, long time in this city. And the reason is that the state legislature has taken away from cities the ability to pass laws that would protect tenants. The state legislature, for example, has taken away from cities the ability to have rent controls on vacant apartments, which Berkeley had for many years. If rent control continues to apply when an apartment is vacated, first of all, housing prices don't skyrocket quite as fast. And second, there's less incentive to evict a long-term tenant because you're not going to get more rent. More important, what's happening now is renters are being evicted to turn rental units into condominiums or tenancies in common, which are essentially the same thing. All right. What's happening is we are taking, it's the worst kind of class warfare because it's the middle class against the upper middle class. It's like people with a little bit more money against people with a little bit less money. It's what's happening is landlords, property owners are finding that it's very, very lucrative to clear all the tenants out of a building and flip it and sell it to people who want to buy a place in San Francisco but cannot afford to buy a median-priced home because homes are so incredibly expensive. So you take a six-unit building, you kick all the tenants out, and you turn that into six condos. That is perfectly legal. Under the state's Ellis Act, we cannot stop a landlord from doing that. And that is why every tenant in San Francisco now feels extremely vulnerable. I do not know a single renter who isn't nervous every single day that they're going to lose their home, not because they didn't pay the rent, not because rent control doesn't protect them, but because the Ellis Act is going to allow their landlord to kick everyone out and flip that building for a profit.
There's a case that's getting a lot of attention right now. Ji Lee and her husband, Poon Hung Lee, they've had a three-bedroom apartment on Jackson Street in Chinatown since 1979. They raised seven kids there. And now they and their 48-year-old disabled daughter are the only tenants remaining in the eight-unit complex. On Wednesday at 6 a.m., they're supposed to get out. There's a notice to vacate posted last week in a court order, and there's going to be a massive action tomorrow at this building to try to get them to stay. But what power do they have in
this
case?
Well, we have no legal power. Until the the big city mayors of California and the tenants throughout California can get together and push the state legislature to repeal the Ellis Act, which, by the way, is hard because landlords really control the state legislature. I mean, modest pro-tenant legislation has a very, very tough time up in Sacramento. But as long as that law is in effect, there's nothing legally that can be done to save this family. However, I will say that the mayor of San Francisco could be out there tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock when this happens. And the mayor of San Francisco could be standing up and saying, this is shameful. Call out this speculator who is not doing this to have a place to live. This person has a record of clearing out buildings, flipping them for a profit, right? Destroying lives and families to make more money. So instead of letting these folks call the shots at City Hall, why are we not shaming them? Why, you know, why is the entire Board of Supervisors and the mayor not out there marching tomorrow morning with the tenant advocates and saying, who are you to come into our city and do this? All right. Again, it's like the people who are selling the bottles of water for $100 after the earthquake. Why aren't we even calling them out as a city?
And again, 100 evictions a month.
100 evictions a month. These are people who, for the most part, are gone from San Francisco. They're not only losing their homes, they're losing their city and their community. And, you know, these are people like the family you were talking about on the edge of Chinatown who've been living here for many, many years, who have built a life here, who have friends and neighbors, and their kids were raised here, and now they're gone. There is no way they're going to stay in San Francisco. There is no way that we can build affordable housing fast enough in the city to keep up with all of the evictions. And the housing that we're building is not going to help at all because none of this market rate housing is A, available to people who are getting evicted, or B, bringing down the cost of housing for the rest of us.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, I was listening. I think maybe we heard you say that it looks pretty grim for vacancy control, which is to say limitation of increase on a vacant apartment because that was turned around by the state legislature. But the question that has to be asked, what would it take to realign this so this to call a halt to this rental bubble by organizing communities of renters to do so? What steps can you forecast that it would take to change that part of the climate?
Well, there's a group called Tenants Together, run out of San Francisco by a guy named Dean Preston, who is trying to do it. They're trying to build a statewide tenants organization. We have a very effective local tenants organization. The San Francisco Tenants Union advocates for tenants in town. But there's really nothing statewide that can go up to Sacramento. And I think if we could organize, you know, a million tenants and target the Democrats for the most part, not Republicans, it's the centrist Democrats who are allowing this to happen, and push them, we might get somewhere. But I also think, again, it's going to come when the big city mayors stand up and say, you have taken away our rights. The legislature is also, by the way, has passed a couple of bills saying communities like San Francisco, Los Angeles have to plan for the growth that's going to happen in California between now and the end of the decade. There's this Plan Bay Area for the next 10 or 15 years. What are we going to do? The state legislature is mandating land use policies that will increase density in already developed areas to prevent suburban sprawl. That's fine. But those density policies are going to increase the displacement of existing vulnerable communities. And until the mayors of Los Angeles and Sacramento and San Francisco and San Diego and all these other cities go up to the state legislature and say, give us back the ability to protect our cities, it's not going to happen.
Well, and speaking of infrastructure, Marie writes, between Market and Bryant Streets along 14th and 15th, half of the corners have had buildings torn down and huge apartment buildings are going up at a very speedy rate. This is just a small example of the building craze going on. When Silicon Valley was IT, a teacher called in and stated that she's teaching some of the children of the dot-com workers but can't afford to live there. It's the situation here now. And again, we're going to have 4,000 new housing units in the coming months. So, Gray, what does this mean for the city's infrastructure, and who's going to make these decisions? Because we're going to see major changes and a huge influx of new people in the city.
Well, the most superficial thing is that the infrastructure is going to be more and more unpleasant to use. It's going to be stretched to the limits, as it is largely already. And I'm talking about the public transit, which anybody will notice that they try to use it. I was just in Berlin, actually, which is a very pleasant city because they have very few high-rises and they have an excellent system of public transit. And it was startling how much more pleasant it was to be in that city it's a quiet city. That's amazing because people don't have to drive, actually. So, but that's not my main concern. When Dianne Feinstein was mayor, there was a very good, very smart head of the PUC named Dick Sklar, whom I believe Mayor Moscone had appointed. And in San Francisco, the heads of the PUC have a voting right on the Planning Commission. And Dick made the outrageous claim that the developers should put in more for the development of infrastructure because the high-rises that were going up were simply overloading it. Dianne Feinstein didn't like that. She was very pro-development, et cetera, and so she got him off the Planning Commission, off of the PUC. Well, what's happened since then, and particularly in the last few years, is that these high-rises are going up and these mega lofts, et cetera, without expanding the infrastructure at the same time. That's making San Francisco an extraordinarily dangerous city. I'm something of an authority on the 1906 earthquake and fire, and there's a major difference between now and 1906, and that it can be summed up by one word, gasoline. And so what we have now is an infrastructure which is absolutely incapable of putting out fires in massed high-rises. They just keep going up, but the infrastructure, the firefighting infrastructure, is not keeping pace with this very, very dangerous situation. I would never live in San Francisco now. I just think it's too dangerous.
Really?
Yes. I talked with one of the fire chiefs at one time. I said, what happens? Because remember, San Francisco is still largely a wooden city, with the exception of the downtown. I said, what happens if fires start in the high-rises in the downtown? He said, we cordon it off. Ooh. We quarantine it because we're going to have so much trouble putting out fires elsewhere in the city. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the height of irresponsibility, what they are doing. And I'm not even talking about what's going to happen as sea levels rise and we begin getting tidal surges in the lower parts of the city as well, too, which will flood out the infrastructure there, including, for example, BART, as happened during Hurricane Sandy in New York City.
Again, getting back to what you're talking about, Rose, who's making these decisions? Well, the city, the elected officials who are running San Francisco, are not making the decision that needs to be made around who pays for this infrastructure. I mean, it's the developers are so totally calling the shots here that all of this stuff is getting built without anybody saying who's paying not only for Muni, who's paying for new schools, who's paying for the libraries, who's paying for all of the things that are necessary to absorb 4,000 people. Well, a couple things have happened. Again, the real estate lobby in Sacramento has forced decisions onto cities that make it, that mandate all of this increased density. And the city of San Francisco is not saying to the developers, I mean, look what we're doing with the Warriors. All right. We have basically said, the mayor has said, we are going to build this stadium on the waterfront. This is going to be my legacy project. No one is saying to the billionaire owners of the Warriors, wait. First, you got to build us a new Muni line. Right. So people can get to the games. It's the same thing with the Millennium Towers and Rincon Tower and all these new high-rise residential projects that are going up. The mayor is not saying, and the Planning Commission is not saying to these developers, first, you pay for the impacts. You pay for the Muni service. The amount, it has been proven over and over again, that the amount that developers pay to the city in fees does not come close to covering the cost of the transit alone, much less the other infrastructure. Well, because real estate interests are so calling the shots in the city these days, we can't get that done.
What about the tax break that was given to Twitter? It's now called the Twitter tax break. Twitter and other companies that move to the Central Market and Tenderloin areas do not have to pay a 1.5% city payroll tax for 6 years. Spotify recently applied for the tax break. And, I mean, Twitter got the tax break. They're expected to go public in the coming months, and they're valued at $10 billion, with a B, $10 billion.
And they don't want to pay their taxes. In fact, the secret, part of what was behind this, of course, is that Twitter employees didn't want to have to pay payroll taxes on the huge profits they're going to make when the company goes public, because those stock options were potentially taxable under the city's 1.5% payroll tax. At any rate, these folks are going to make a lot of money. and they're becoming wealthy. And, you know, the 1.5% city payroll tax, I ran a small business in the city for a long time at The Guardian. The 1.5% payroll tax is not onerous. It is not a burden. It does not destroy jobs. It's nothing compared to what else you spend on employees. You spend more than that 1.5% recruiting and training people. But we are that decision was driven in part by the mayor wanting Twitter in, but also the Shorenstein Company owned that building, that big Furniture Mart building that had been vacant for a long time. And the one who's really making out here is Doug Shorenstein and his company, because they're the ones who got a tenant for a building that had been vacant for a long time, a tenant who's paying them phenomenal rents. And every landlord in mid-market is seeing the value of their property soar. So, in fact, we're seeing nonprofits and small businesses being evicted from mid-market as those land values soar. So that's who, in a sense, you know, I know the mayor was very entranced by having Twitter come there, but it was the Shorenstein Company that really made out.
Well, it was an 8-3 vote on the board.
Yes, it was. It was an 8-3 vote on the board.
So I moderated this conversation in the Mission last night about these issues. Oh. And a lot of the panelists said, what happened? I mean, 20 years ago, you had a very progressive board that had a lot of power. And they said, frankly, we won a lot of these fights. And things have just completely shifted. So what happened?
Well, a couple of things have happened. And one is that the landowners have gotten better at figuring out how to deal with district elections. You know, these folks, when you're talking about one guy making $50 million in a couple of months off of one building, the stakes are pretty high here. And these folks have figured out where to put money and how to do this. They also succeeded in taking the, essentially taking the mayor's office out of the electoral realm. They essentially managed to put Ed Lee in a very close contested vote at the, you know, after Gavin Newsom became lieutenant governor, put him in office on a promise that he would only serve as an interim mayor, which he quickly, almost, you know, immediately started walking back and then backtracked on completely when Willie Brown and his allies in the real estate community pushed him on this because they were afraid that San Francisco might get a mayor who was more amenable to protections for existing vulnerable populations and less gung-ho about this kind of development. It's actually, it is astonishing the changes in San Francisco politics in the last decade.
Can I also say, it has a lot to do with San Francisco's, and I should say the Bay Area's, the nation's impoverished media environment, that San Francisco 100 years ago had a very rich and competitive newspaper field, four morning papers, major morning papers, three of them owned by leading families in San Francisco who hated one another. And so if you wanted to find out the dirt on the Spreckles family, you'd read the DeYoung or the Hearst paper. But of course, that's all gone. And Willie Brown famously did some fancy horse trading back in the last century to assure that San Francisco became a one newspaper town. So the Chronicle is now the only newspaper of record, and you can see how anorexic it's becoming as they've gotten rid of their staff. So people simply don't have the information. Fortunately, we still have an alternate press, although Tim was just fired from the Bay Guardian, which had previously had a great deal of power because they put out a voter guide, a very progressive voter guide that many people used. Well, I doubt very much that that's going to be available in the future, and that's really going to affect politics in San Francisco.
Let me just say, that's one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing now and setting up this nonprofit online daily. I actually think that in 10 years, the Chronicle will be gone. I mean, it's withering away to such, I mean, it's so small now, and it'll be gone as a daily print publication. The days of the one paper dominating local politics are over. The good news is we may end up with half a dozen online dailies, none of them with a staff of 250, but all of them with a staff of 10 or 12. And maybe we'll be back to the days that Gray was talking about when we actually had a progressive daily and a more conservative daily and three or four others and real newspaper competition because it will all be on the web. And that is a potentially positive outcome of this and potentially a diffusion of political power through the media. Because if we have, you know, if 10 years from now we have half a dozen competing online dailies, that makes it harder for anyone to centralize control and power.
Well, we've got just about 7 minutes left. I want to get as many calls as we can.
Sure.
So let's hear from Aaron in San Francisco. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to call. I know I met you last night, but I wanted to just talk a little bit about two of the projects that I'm working on, both of which are looking at tenant displacement in San Francisco, and also looking at some of the speculators and landlords responsible for LSAC evictions and owner move-in evictions, buyouts, et cetera. One of the projects is called the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, and we're mapping the demographics of displacement in San Francisco and like looking at what communities are being displaced, which, as we all would guess, are predominantly subaltern communities, like communities of color, queer communities, working class communities, et cetera. And we're also documenting some of the stories of folks being displaced, and all that's going to be on a publicly accessible map pretty shortly, which people can find at anti-evictionmappingproject.net. And then the other project is called Eviction Free San Francisco, and we're actually organizing direct actions targeting specific landlords and speculators. And two of the cases, which I mentioned last night in the Jack Spade meeting, which are pretty poignant, are cases of landlords and speculators who live out of town or who are subsidiaries of other businesses who are completely disconnected from San Francisco, who are evicting seniors and disabled folks from the city. Right now we're working on a campaign for Jeremy Nichols, who's been living in the Castro for about 19 years. He's a senior, he's disabled, he's been fighting AIDS for over 10 years, and he's being evicted by a landlord who lives in Atherton, whose friends formed a small LLC called 460 Noe LLC based in Union City. And
can I just ask you just quickly, when is he being evicted?
His official eviction date was actually September 10th, and he is still residing in his home, not sure, you know, when he's actually going to be removed by the sheriff.
Well, thank you so much for calling. We'll put links to these links. I mean, this is just, this is one of the 100 a month that's happening, Tim. Do you think these actions will do anything?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what will. And I certainly think that a more vigorous campaign by people like your caller and advocates to point out who these folks are that are doing the evictions. You know, we're talking on the show about who's controlling the city, who's controlling the housing stock in the city. Who are these people? I mean, if you can hide behind a real estate investment trust and you can sit in your house in Atherton and throw a guy who's, you know, a disabled man out on the streets, because I know Jeremy Nichols too. I've written about him. There is no way that this person will be able to continue living in San Francisco. And he considers that possibly a death sentence, because he's a man living with AIDS who is getting treated at Davies, where there are experts in his health condition. He's worried that he's going to be forced way out of the city and away from his community. Who's doing this? And I think that's one of the things that we all need to focus on. Who are these people who are doing this? And, you know, maybe we ought to be having demonstrations in front of their house in Atherton.
I just want to slightly disagree with Tim on one point. He keeps saying these people will be forced out of the city. No, some of them will just be forced onto the street. First, they'll go into their car if they have a car. But one of the things that's so striking about San Francisco and Berkeley and Oakland at this point is the incredible disparity between obscene wealth and obscene poverty. So many people are now out on the streets amidst these enormous rising luxury megastructures. This is a state of savagery. It is not a civilization.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because a number of homeless organizations say demand from homeless families in San Francisco is up 30% this year alone. You're seeing so many more homeless people at the Pal BART station on the ground.
Yes.
In the Tenderloin, you see people curled up in balls without even cardboard boxes under their bodies. I mean, I've never really seen it this bad.
Night, you'll see elderly people come out and scavenge in the garbage cans.
I'm seeing so much more of that, too. So, Gray, I want to ask you, I mean, when you look back at, okay, we're in 2013. Let's say 1913, 1963, when you saw major changes in the city that were similar to what we're seeing now, what are the changes, what are the major changes, and what can we learn from that time?
Well, I have to speak for my project, the Living New Deal, because what we're trying to do is to learn from what we once had when Franklin Roosevelt was president. And what you had there was a series of policies as well as public works, which in fact created greater equality for people. It lessened this vast chasm, which is opening up, but a war has been waged against that since Roosevelt's death, and particularly in the last 30 years since Ronald Reagan, and it's been largely successful. And what's resulted in is what Robert Reich talks about all the time, and his movie is just coming out, this colossal gulf in inequality, which is opening up. And along with it, not only crime, but the incredible social unrest, which is obviously going to result from that, which we're already seeing in places like Greece, for example.
Oh, and crime in the Mission is up 30%.
Oh, it's enormous, yeah. I mean, crime is what we call class warfare in this United States.
You know, the Coalition on Homelessness will tell you that one of the leading causes of homelessness in San Francisco is eviction.
Mm-hmm.
Gray is absolutely right that a lot of the people who you're seeing on the streets now are people who once had a place to live, and many of them have jobs.
Mm-hmm. People who are concerned about this, how should they respond to these changes? Final thoughts, Tim?
You should respond to these changes by getting active, by getting involved in community organizations, and by doing research, by talking about if you're facing an eviction, who is actually behind this, who is your landlord, who is doing this, trying to put pressure on them individually, and working with tenant groups that are trying to build a statewide presence so that we can get rid of some of these laws.
Gray?
Well, I have to go back to my guttering hope is what Tim talked about, a much richer online media environment, because the first thing is people have to know what's happening. That requires investigative reporting, and that's what we're not getting now. And I'm very, very grateful, Rose, to your program, actually, for providing a kind of breathing hole as the pond freezes over. Thank you so much for KELW.
Well, thank you. And we're also on KOSP in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much. Greg Brecken is an historical geographer and visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography. And thank you for bringing the historical context to the conversation, because that's often missing and it's so important. And Gray is author of Imperial San Francisco. Tim Redmond is the former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He's having a fundraiser for his new venture, San Francisco Progressive Media Center, this Thursday at El Rio in the Mission, 6 to 9 p.m. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having the show.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How does restorative justice work in California? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about programs in prisons that bring victims and offenders of violent crimes together in dialogue. How do these programs work, and what can be gained from alternative methods of rehabilitation? We'll learn more about restorative justice with members of the Insight Prison Project, a nonprofit that works inside San Quentin. What do you want to know about restorative justice? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.